Blindness by Emily C. Learman. On March 19, 1927, a woman came to me who was affected with temporary blindness. She was not with me longer than 5 minutes when I noticed that she was under an intense mental and nervous strain. When I spoke to her, tears welled up in her eyes. Every part of her body was tense and the white parts of her eyes, i.e., the sclera, were bloodshot and she had no desire to keep them open in a natural way. She told me that she had had trouble with her eyes as long as she could remember. Blocks of blind spots were visible before her eyes at all times, blindness caused by strain. She said she always kept her glasses near her bed so that she could put them on first thing in the morning. Her sight was better at night than in the daytime. The daylight caused her a great deal of discomfort and pain, and most of the time she had a desire to keep her eyelids lowered. When she was wearing her glasses, she felt more depressed than when not wearing them. Her eyes itched and she had rubbed her eyelids until they had become sore. This caused her to be more nervous than ever. Long periods of daily sun treatment finally cured the itching of her eyelids. When I tested her sight with the test card, her right vision was 15/20, but she strained very hard to see the letters, which gave her eyes the appearance of being closed. The vision of the left eye was 15/50, and it caused her pain when she read with it. I encouraged her to palm, and while her eyes were closed, I asked her to talk about her loved ones at home. As she told me of some of their habits and how she loved them, I noticed her smile for the first time. She was taught to stand with her feet 1 foot apart and sway her body from left to right, flashing the test card letters one at a time. I reminded her many times to blink her eyes in order to stop the stare, for she stared a great deal. When she finally learned how to blink while swaying, her vision improved to 15/15 with each eye separately. I then had her sit in a chair with her back to the sunlight and gave her the fundamental card to hold. I asked her what she could read on it. She said she could not read any of the print at all on the card. I told her to shift from the white spaces of the microscopic type to the white spaces between the lines of the seven truths of normal sight, which she held with the fundamental card. Flashing only the white spaces and avoiding the reading of print. This practice was kept up for almost a half hour, and I then suggested that she notice the numbers at the beginning of each sentence of the fundamental card. Her attention was drawn to the period next to each number. She was told to notice the white spaces of the different sized type as she held it in her hand. Then look at the period, then the letters. Before her first treatment was over, she read the sentences from number 1 to number 5. At the beginning of her second treatment, she said that the food placed before her at the table was beginning to look like food to her before she ate it. Before, she never knew what she was eating until she tasted it. Sun treatment was kept up regularly every day. This improved her vision for the test card and fine print to normal. I handed her a newspaper and pointed to the smallest type that I could find on the front page. The smallest print was about the size of diamond type. She read this clearly for the first time in her life. During her second treatment, when she held the card in the sunlight, her vision improved for the fundamentals card to number 8. After several treatments, she told me that her friends were noticing how much younger she looked. The sclera of both eyes was clearing up and she was smiling most of the time. She became able to read all of the fundamental card at reading distance, 10 or 12 inches from her eyes and sometimes closer. The blind spots and black spots that had appeared before her eyes for many years also disappeared. She was told to remain in the sun for hours at a time, keeping her eyes closed while her head moved slowly from side to side. The sway of the body was advised, and she did this 100 times in the morning and 100 times at night before retiring. She told me how much better she slept at night since having had her first treatment. She said it had been many years since she had had a restful night's sleep. She enjoys walking fast on the street now, noticing stationary objects moving in the opposite direction as she walks. She reads numbers in the telephone book and other print that was not clear before. Since she has been cured, she is helping others and writes about her eyes continuing to be a blessing to her. This patient has proved again that faithful practice and patience brings about the much desired result, normal vision. She describes her own case in the following way. Before I was treated by Ms. Learman for the improvement of my sight, an American flag a short distance away looked to me like a dark piece of cloth hanging from a pole. Now I can clearly distinguish the colors, the red, the white, the blue, and I believe I could count each star if the flag would stay still long enough. For many years, the first thing I would do on awakening in the morning would be to look for my eyeglasses. I could not see or find anything without them. At the dinner table, I could not see a small fishbone on my plate, in a poorly lighted room, much less other things that the normal eye sees without any effort. Now I can see the tiny crumbs, even though they may be as white as the color of my tablecloth. Along the street, whether I was walking or riding, I could not read signs as the normal eye does. After my second treatment, all signs along the street and shop windows were easily seen by me. Before I started treatment, I could not see any objects moving at all. They all seemed to stand still. Now I can see all objects moving, that are moving, and since I have learned how relaxing the sway of the body is, I can imagine stationary objects are moving as I sway. If I carried an umbrella or a purse on my arm, I would hold so tightly to these things that the effort caused pain in my hands and arms before I realized it. Now my arms and hands feel relaxed and I carry packages, an umbrella, and other things without causing strain or effort. Things now come easily to me. Perhaps others who are troubled in this way would be glad to know how I was cured of this particular strain and tension caused by holding on tightly to things unnecessarily. Mrs. Learman taught me how to place the palm of one hand gently, easily on the palm of the other hand. At first I did not do it gently enough for her and we practiced it together. My strain was so great, which she realized too, that I was willing to follow her in any suggestion that she made for my comfort and relief from strain. This helped me so much that I began to uncross my knees for more relaxation and rest. This helps more than one realizes, and now since I know it does, I notice that 9 out of 10 people are under attention most of the time because their knees are crossed. For years, I have been under constant strain and tension, which caused greater depression than anything else. Since I have taken the treatment and followed Ms. Learman's suggestions for home treatment, I no longer feel depressed. After my second treatment, I could thread a needle and I was not particular either as to the size of the eye of the needle. I believe this is worth reporting because for many years I had to have my glasses handy to thread a needle, whether the eye was large or small, it made no difference. Since I was treated, a friend of mine drew my attention to something away off in the sky. She pointed to this object and said, "Look at that balloon in the distance." I looked and said, "No, it is a kite. I can see the tail clearly." The kite became visible to my friend and she remarked how much better my eyes were since I had discarded glasses. I have much cause to be grateful for my renewed vision. Questions and answers. Q. Is memory and imagination the same? When we remember an object, do we have to visualize it? A. The memory and imagination are not the same. It is best when you remember an object to visualize it with the help of the imagination, but it is not always necessary to visualize it. The brain will automatically produce a mental picture of the object. Q. When I try to imagine a black period, it blurs and I get all colors but black. A. When you fail to imagine a black period, it means that you are making an effort to see black. It may help you to think of a black football that has been thrown into the ocean and is being carried further and further from shore. As it recedes in the distance, it becomes smaller and smaller until it seems only a small black speck or period. Q. Why is it a rest to read fine print? I should think it would be a strain. A. Fine print can be read perfectly only when the eyes are relaxed. If any effort is made, the print immediately blurs. It is, therefore, evident that the more fine print you are able to read, the more continuously relaxed your eyes and mind are. Fine print activates perfect central fixation, and improves close and distant vision. See Oppositional Movement Chapter 17 in the book, Do It Yourself, Natural Eyesight Improvement, Original and Modern Bates Method. Q. I am following your method for squint. While riding in an automobile, or train, is it necessary for me to palm? A. No. It is beneficial to observe the universal swing, that is, looking in the distance and noticing that everything on the horizon, the clouds, treetops, etc., seem to move in the same direction in which you are moving. Without looking directly at near objects, you are conscious of the fact that they seem to be moving past in the opposite direction. Remember to blink frequently, as the normal eye does. Perfect sight. If you learn the fundamental principles of perfect sight and will consciously keep them in mind, your defective vision will disappear. The following discoveries were made by W. H. Bates, M.D., and his method is based on them. With it he has cured so-called incurable cases, I many blind people are curable. 2. All errors of refraction are functional, therefore curable. 3. All defective vision is due to strain in some form. You can demonstrate to your own satisfaction that strain lowers the vision. When you stare, you strain. Look fixedly at one object for 5 seconds or longer. What happens? The object blurs and finally disappears. Also, your eyes are made uncomfortable by this experiment. When you rest your eyes for a few moments, the vision is improved and the discomfort relieved. 4. Strain is relieved by relaxation. To use your eyes correctly all day long, it is necessary that you, 1. Blink frequently. Staring is a strain and always lowers the vision. 2. Shift your glance constantly from one point to another, seeing the part regarded best and other parts not so clearly. That is, when you look at a chair, do not try to see the whole object at once, look first at the back of it, seeing that part best and other parts worse. Remember to blink as you quickly shift your glance from the back to the seat and legs, seeing each part best, in turn. This is central fixation. 3. Your head and eyes are moving all day long. Imagine that stationary objects are moving in the direction opposite to the movement of your head and eyes. When you walk about the room or on the street, notice that the floor or pavement seems to come toward you, while objects on either side appear to move in the direction opposite to the movement of your body. Oppositional movement. The Stare. By W. H. Bates, M.D. Much can be written about the stare. In the first place, when a patient stares, an effort is always made to hold the eyes still without moving them. It is impossible to hold the eyes perfectly still. Trying to do the impossible always requires a strain. This strain can be demonstrated to be a mental strain which affects all the nerves of the body as well as the eye. With a mental strain, the memory and imagination become imperfect and imperfect sight results. Pain, fatigue, or dizziness are acquired or made worse. With relaxation of all the nerves, the sense of touch is improved, but with the stare or other efforts to see, the sense of touch is lost while the sense of pain is increased. Staring equal not moving / shifting the eyes. Keeping the eyes, visual attention on only one part of a object without shifting on the part, without shifting to a new part, or trying to see all parts of a object or all objects in the central and peripheral field clear at the same time without shifting part to part, object to object. This is diffusion, eccentric fixation. These two types of staring result in strain and unclear vision. Glaucoma, acute or chronic, has been consciously produced by the stare. The fundamental symptoms of glaucoma may be present with or without increased hardness of the eyeball, contraction of the nasal field, or glaucomatous excavation of the optic nerve. In glaucoma, the blood vessels of the retina appear to be arranged in the form of a right angle just as they dip down into the nerve. The whole papilla where the optic nerve enters the back part of the eye is all white instead of pink. Changes which are seen in the optic nerve are organic. The contracted field may be considered to be functional because there are many cases which recover and the field becomes clear. This suggested that in glaucoma the patient be recommended to alternately stare and relax. When he is staring and trying to improve the vision by an effort, all the symptoms of glaucoma may be increased. If the stare is the cause of glaucoma, relaxation should always lessen the severity of the symptoms. There are some patients who have been using the stare to improve their vision for a sufficient length of time to acquire the habit without being conscious that an effort was being made. Each individual case may require individual treatment in order that the patient may become, by practice, conscious of the stare when the vision is lowered. Of course, if the stare increases the glaucoma, by stopping the stare we would expect the eye to improve. If it does not improve, the patient is still staring, whether he knows it or not. Sometimes by increasing the distance of the test card from the eyes while the patient is staring, he often becomes able to demonstrate that the stare is present when the vision becomes worse. Many adults past middle life unconsciously stare and produce glaucoma. By practice, they become conscious of the stare. While the stare, when it is strong enough and sufficiently prolonged, usually increases the hardness of the eyeball, in the matter of treatment the great problem is to suggest measures which will enable the patient to demonstrate that the stare is the cause of increased tension of the eyeball in glaucoma. Absolute glaucoma is a serious disease and the stare can become so great that a large amount of pain and total blindness will be produced. The pain may be so severe that many ophthalmologists feel justified in removing the eyeball to bring relief. While many cases of absolute glaucoma obtained much relief from pain after the removal of the eyeball, there were too many cases which still had severe trouble, even after such an operation. A strain which produces absolute glaucoma is really a mental strain and not a local one entirely. Trigeminal neuralgia is also a very serious eye trouble. Many operations have been performed for its relief, most of which were failures. Some patients have had nearly all of the fifth nerve with its branches removed in order to relieve the pain. There are many patients who have not obtained permanent relief from pain after various methods of orthodox treatment were employed. In the severest cases, the branches of the fifth nerve at their origin in the Gasserian ganglion in the brain have been removed, as well as the ganglia, without any permanent benefit whatever. I have discovered that the stare was the cause of the brain tension and that when the stare was relieved, all the symptoms of trigeminal neuralgia were relieved or cured and the vision became normal. Conical cornea has for many years been considered incurable. A great many operations have been performed in which a small part of the cornea was removed with the expectation that when it healed the conical shape of the cornea would be corrected and the vision would thereby be improved. These operations were usually a disappointment. Conical cornea has been treated by relaxation methods and with great success. When the forefinger of one hand is held about 6 inches to one side of the face and about 6 inches straight ahead, the patient, by moving the head and eyes from side to side slowly or rapidly, can imagine the movement of the finger from side to side. This movement of the finger is called the variable swing and is specific for the benefit of all cases of conical cornea. It owes its value to the fact that when the finger appears to move, the injurious stare is prevented. The length of time necessary to improve the vision with the help of the variable swing usually is not very long. Iritis occurs quite frequently. The cause has heretofore been ascribed to syphilis, rheumatism, or some other constitutional disease. Chronic cases are seldom cured until after months of persistent treatment. Pain in acute iritis may be very severe and the vision is usually lowered. while treating patients in one of the outpatient departments of a city hospital, one of them applied for treatment of iritis, which had produced so much blindness that he required an attendant to help him. The eyeball was very red, the pupil contracted, and the vision very imperfect. He suffered very much from photophobia or sensitiveness to light and kept his eyes covered most of the time. I turned him over to my assistant with directions to obtain relaxation by palming, swinging, or the memory of perfect sight. 1/2 hour later, the patient disturbed the clinic by laughing frequently, because the symptoms of iritis had almost entirely disappeared. He walked about the place, telling anyone who would listen to him about his prompt recovery. This patient was able to increase the symptoms of iritis by the stare and lessen them by relaxation. Surgeon creates corneal astigmatism. It may not be generally known that the stare is the cause of corneal astigmatism. With the aid of the ophthalmometer, most cases of corneal astigmatism can be diagnosed and measured. The ability of some people to produce corneal astigmatism is interesting. Some years ago, a house surgeon in one of our largest hospitals acquired considerable notoriety or fame by his ability to produce temporarily a considerable amount of corneal astigmatism by staring at the opening tube of the ophthalmometer. He spent many hours experimenting on his eyes, and he had become able not only to produce astigmatism at an angle of 90 degrees but also at an angle of 180 degrees. It required many months of constant practice before he became able, with the aid of the stare, to produce astigmatism with an oblique axis. Although he enjoyed the experimental work, which had for its object the cure of corneal astigmatism, so many doctors criticized him adversely that he stopped. It was believed at one time by many physicians that myopia was caused by straining to see at the near point. Experiments to produce nearsightedness by an effort to see at the near point were failures. All the men, and there were many, who tried to produce nearsightedness or to lengthen the eyeball by efforts to see at the near point and so produce myopia, found instead the opposite condition, hypermetropia, unclear close vision, with a shortening of the eyeball. The stare can produce a different kind of strain in each case and therefore cause a different eye defect or disease. Some years ago, a friend of mine called to see me and to learn about my experiments. I said to him, "Doctor, would you like to see a case of cataract produced and cured?" I took him into a dark room where one of my patients, a woman about 70 years of age, was seated. After he had seen her, he recognized her as one of his former patients. He told me in a low voice that arrangements had been made for taking her into a hospital and operating upon her eye. I gave him an ophthalmoscope with a +18 convex glass, which produced a very much enlarged image of the cataract. I asked the doctor if he could see the cataract, and he replied that the area of the pupil was completely filled with the cataract, and that there was no red reflex. He said that he believed that one would be justified in operating for its removal. "Before we do that," I said, "suppose we look at the lens again." So we looked at the lens again with the ophthalmoscope, and again he showed me that it was a proper case for operation. "Well," I said, "suppose we keep looking at the cataract for a few minutes." I asked the patient if she had a good memory for flowers. She replied that she had. I asked her what flower she could remember best. She answered, "I believe I can remember a yellow chrysanthemum better than any other flower." I then said to the doctor, "How is the cataract?" "Why," he said, "it has disappeared." He was evidently very much puzzled. I then asked the patient if she could remember my first name. She answered, "No," I said. "Suppose you try." She immediately began to stare, and the upper part of the lens became opaque and all the muscles of her face were under a strain. We investigated this case for half an hour or longer and came to the conclusion that the memory of perfect sight was a cure for cataract, and the memory of imperfect sight, which is usually associated with a stare, the cause of cataract. the relief of eye strain or the stare has benefited so many heretofore considered incurable cases that the conclusions made should be investigated. If it is true that the stare can cause so much pain or suffering, it is a breach of medical ethics for any doctor to deprive a man or woman of relief by the use of such simple successful methods of treatment. Staring Relieved by Treatment. By Emily C. Learman. A woman who had been suffering from pain and imperfect sight was sent to me for treatment. She suffered more at business than at any other time, and glasses did not help her much. Having charge of a tea room, she was continually greeting patrons and placing them at tables. At times she seemed to have no trouble at all with her eyes and was able to read any part of the menu to patrons who asked her to do so, without using her glasses, which she wore most of the time. She had worn glasses off and on for 4 years and disliked them exceedingly, because they did not become her. Shortly before coming to me, she was told by an eye specialist that she would have to wear bifocals. She was ready, then, to try most anything rather than wear them. Her vision for the test card was 15/20 in both eyes, but with fine print and ordinary type, she did not do so well. I began treating her by having her palm, and while her eyes were closed and covered, I explained that some patients were not helped by palming, but if that were so in her case, we would try something else. She had a good memory for objects and people's faces, but her memory for names was not so good. I asked her to describe to me all the sections of the tea room that she could remember. In this way, her memory and imagination would improve for other things which were not remembered or imagined so well. She described in detail how the tables were arranged and the design of the table silver. She could not remember the pattern of the tablecloths and napkins, although when she purchased the table linens, she purposely selected a certain pattern because it appealed to her. This worried her, but I explained that after she had learned how to relax under unfavorable conditions, she would be able to remember such details. I directed her to keep her eyes closed for more than half an hour, at times keeping perfectly still without speaking to me. I watch patients very closely while they are palming to see whether they are in a comfortable position, and if not, I try to arrange it so. I find that when the knees are crossed, the position soon brings on an unconscious strain, therefore I direct the patient to keep the knees uncrossed. Then I arrange the feet so that they are comfortably placed either on the floor or on a footstool or hassock. The patient is usually most comfortable in an armchair, and if the arms of the chair are not upholstered, I place a cushion under one elbow in such a way that the patient is most comfortable. This brings the patient in a position leaning over to the right side or to the left, so I try to have the patient change the position while relaxing by reversing the cushion to the opposite arm of the chair. With children, I manage a little differently, especially when not tall enough to rest their feet on a footstool. It is best to place the cushion on the lap or a table for both left and right elbows to rest upon. This keeps good posture, evenly aligned and relaxed body, shoulders, neck, head. The test card, which I used for this patient, had an extra line of letters smaller than the 10-line letters, which are read by the normal eye at 10 feet. After this woman had palmed sufficiently, I removed the footstool, and while her eyes were still closed, I told her to stand up and to start swaying her body slowly with an easy sway of the body from left to right. Then I told her to open her eyes and look from one edge of the Snellen test card to the other and to tell me what the letters were as I pointed toward them. She read every letter of the test card with each eye separately without any difficulty whatever. The patient was so excited over her sudden improvement in sight and the relaxation which she felt of her whole body, that she thought one lesson was all that would be necessary for her. I thought that the improvement during her first treatment was only temporary and told her so. However, I was willing to give the patient the benefit of the doubt and told her that if her vision remained normal and she felt no more strain or discomfort, that it surely would not be necessary for her to take another lesson. Early the next morning my telephone rang and it was she, explaining her discomfort and strain and begging me to see her again. I was surprised that the change came so soon. I thought that she would have at least a few days of relaxation and freedom from strain, but she had been at a bridge party after seeing me and something had happened to her during the course of the evening which brought her quickly to me the next day. I feared that it would worry her if she could not do so well during her second treatment with the large Snellen test card, so we worked together with another part of the method. This time we used fine print. I sat directly in front of her as she looked at the little card with fine print, but it was pitiful to see her staring at it, trying to read. Staring is such a common thing and most people stare unconsciously at times. A great many people stare unconsciously most of the time and cause much or all of the discomfort which soon brings on chronic trouble with the eyes and sometimes causes blindness. If school teachers were instructed to remind pupils at intervals during the daily sessions of the permanent punishment to their eyes as the result of staring, it would be avoided in time and less eyeglasses would be prescribed for school children. People do not wait until they are physically tired out before they sit or lie down to rest, but most people do not know what to do about their eyes when they are mentally tired. In some cases, just closing the eyes frequently for a second or two is all that is necessary to retain good vision for life. This I know to be true because my grandmother, who lived until she was 79 years of age, did not wear glasses at all until she was over 70 years of age, and then they were not fitted by an oculist, but were purchased at the price of 10 cents from a solicitor who came to her door. She used them only when threading a fine needle. Without glasses, she could see fine stitches while sewing, whether the thread was black or white. What I particularly remember was that she blinked her eyes often, which I thought at the time was a mistake or an affliction, but since I have become Dr. Bates' assistant, I know that she was doing the natural thing. If all mothers would watch their babies as they begin to notice things and avoid any possible stare by just attracting the baby's attention to various things instead of just one thing, I believe that a great deal of squint could be avoided, as well as other eye troubles. Of course, there are squint cases which have been brought on through illness or injury of some kind, but even these cases can be eventually cured by teaching the patient how to shift and blink and avoid the stare. I informed this patient that her principal trouble was staring and that I noticed it more on her second visit than I did at the first. She was told to close her eyes and while they were closed to remember a white cloud or a piece of white cloth, such as her handkerchief, which was in her lap at the time, then to open her eyes and instead of looking directly at the fine black print she was to look at the white spaces, and then close her eyes again and imagine them as white as her handkerchief. She said she could remember a white cloud much better while her eyes were closed. While looking at her handkerchief she could see it perfectly white, but when she closed her eyes the memory of the white handkerchief was not so good. She said the whiteness became sort of gray or a soiled white, which made her uncomfortable while her eyes were closed. This proves again that Dr. Bates is right in saying that an imperfect memory of anything brings on strain and imperfect sight. At first she could not do so well with the white spaces of fine print as she held the card 6 or 8 inches from her eyes. We tried the other extreme then by placing the card close to her forehead, too close for her to read the fine print, even if she had no trouble with her eyes. She was directed to move the card slowly, slightly touching her forehead over the bridge of her nose and opening her eyes with the slow movement of the card and closing them again. In this way, she got flashes of the white spaces, and as she closed her eyes the memory of the white spaces improved so that when she drew the card away finally after practicing this method for 10 or 15 minutes she could read the fine print at 6 inches as well as she could at 12 inches. Again she became excited as she did the day before and felt that at last she had grasped the idea of avoiding the stare and that she would not need to come again. 2 days later she telephoned me for another treatment, saying that she could not retain the good sight that she had while practicing with me. When she came for her third treatment, I tested her sight with the large test card, using various cards that I had. She did very well with the two cards she had read at her first visit, but with the strange cards her vision was the same as it was during her first visit, 15/20. I decided to try a different method of treatment by having her imagine that my room was her tea room. A desk and small table with a few chairs were imagined to be tables at which she was to place imaginary patrons who were coming toward her. She told me that it was customary for her to have a napkin in her hand, which served sometimes to wipe the top of a glass or to rearrange a plate on the table. I gave her a towel to hold, which served as a napkin, and told her to shift from the napkin to the imaginary table, and in this way, she learned how to shift and blink as she would have to do to retain her relaxation while at work in the tea room. She remembered this lesson very well and did her work in the tea room better for a few days. When I saw her again, which was in less than a week's time, she said that she got along splendidly in the mornings, but in the afternoon after she had been busy for part of the day, she felt a strain coming on as usual, which caused a great deal of tension at the back of her head. The method that we used that day at her fourth visit was used again at her last visit, the fifth treatment, when she did so well that I thought it unnecessary for her to come again. There were several pictures hanging on the wall of my room distributed in different places. I told her to imagine that she was in her stockroom where canned goods were stored. She explained how there were rows of canned tomatoes, which had the picture of a red tomato on the label. Then there were other shelves arranged with cans of peas, which, of course, were green. There were shelves in another section of the room with canned vegetables, with various colored labels. I told her to stand in the center of the room and to sway her body from left to right, blinking as she swayed and shifted from the canned peas to the canned tomatoes and other canned goods with various colored labels. She remarked that if she could keep up that good feeling of relaxation and freedom from tension and strain while she was practicing in the stockroom of her establishment, she would be amply repaid for the time she spent with me. Her report over the telephone a few days later was favorable. She said that she had taken her car with friends and had driven many miles over a mountain trail, and if it had not been for her ability to blink and shift, she could not possibly have avoided an accident which would have thrown her car over the cliffs. I had told her to occasionally shift from the speedometer to the center of the road ahead and vice versa. I told her to remind herself continuously that it was not necessary to hold on very tight to the steering wheel, but to hold it loosely, which meant relaxation. She said that her storeroom, she believed, was responsible for the absence of strain and tension late in the afternoon, when before she had seen me there was not a day that she was free from pain in the back of her head. She wore a fancy white apron during business hours, but always in the little pocket of her apron rested the small test card and a small fine print card which she would use when she had the opportunity to do so, practicing shifting from the white spaces of the fine type to sections of the room, which helped her to see things clearly and without strain. Carry a small rock or piece of jewelry, any colorful, shiny object with a lot of fine details. Shift on the details, colors, sparkles. Relax, blink, let the head, neck, shoulders relax, think something happy. This keeps close and distant vision clear. I hope this article will be of benefit to those who do close work in offices, as well as people who do similar work. To that of my patient. Case report. As is generally known, fevers of all kinds are apt, if not treated with the utmost care, to result in defective eyesight, hearing, and many other troubles, and it was at the age of 6 years, after severe scarlet fever, that my eyes became weak, and subsequently developed a convergent squint. In order to check this defect, it was found necessary to harness me to a pair of huge unsightly spectacles, with the usual thick corrective lenses. As a result of this drastic treatment, my eyes weakened still more, becoming myopic and astigmatic, although the squint had certainly improved, but only at the cost of producing the other complications, for exceptionally strong lenses were used to this end. I continued to pay periodic visits to the best available eye specialists in Johannesburg and Cape Town, South Africa, all of whom at first encouraged me into the belief that eventually I would be able to discard them. Latterly, however, I received no such encouragement, but instead was warned that blindness could result if I went without them at any time. I reached the age of 26 years without having received any benefit from the wearing of glasses. In fact, even more technical terms were introduced into the condition of my eyes, and I had come to the conclusion that nothing could be done for them, and that I would always wear glasses, and that continuous headaches were my lot. Such a dreadful state of mind for anyone to get into. Imagine my joy when at a tea party, they have their uses after all, I heard Drive W.H. Bates' name and methods of treatment mentioned for the first time, that was in 1926, and of course anything to do with the eyes attracted my attention at once. At that time a Ms. Reed and Mr. Jardine, both students of Dr. Bates, had been carrying out exceptionally good work with the Bates method. I immediately consulted with them, overlooking entirely the fact that at that time I had a great deal of work to do which would require the use of my eyes. The first thing I was told to do was to remove my glasses, and not to wear them again, and my implicit obedience in this regard surprised even myself, for since then I have never returned to my glasses. To Mrs. Reed and Mr. Jardine I am forever grateful for what they did. I think what caused me to put such faith in Dr. Bates and his methods was the fact that I had been going to eye specialists for some 20 years, and instead of my eyes being benefited, they became steadily worse, which fact coincided with one of his observations. I carried out the various exercises prescribed, under somewhat difficult circumstances, my entire day being consumed with office work. However, this did not deter me, for I did the modified sway while sitting at the typewriter, got into the habit of blinking, and snatched a peep at the sun as many times a day as time permitted, morning and evening. I palmed my eyes in between, for, understand, at this time my eyes were being called upon to do work which they had never done before. It was indeed a hard and uncomfortable period through which I was passing. In addition to all the relaxation exercises, I did physical exercises to keep me generally fit, and this helped greatly. After 3 weeks, quite by accident, one day, I began to realize the value of relaxation, for up till then I was undergoing too much of a strain. From this time on I steadily improved. Of course, I realized that after having worn glasses for 20 years I couldn't expect to be cured immediately and that it would be only by hard work and patience that eventually my eyes would be normal. I became absorbed in this treatment, and felt that a great deal could still be learned. The fact that my own eyes were not yet normal, urged me to learn more of the methods of treatment by this wonderful system. When in London, I received more benefit from Mr. Price, another student of Dr. Bates, to whom I am very grateful. I feel that if all the followers of Dr. Bates, and there are many, would cooperate, and perhaps pool the knowledge acquired by experience, we could help this treatment to spread throughout the world. What a benefit this would be to humanity at large. Helen Kupferberger. How to obtain perception of light in blindness. Two things have always brought perception of light to blind patients. One is palming, and the other is the swing. The swing may take two forms, one let the patient stand with feet apart, and sway the body, including the head and eyes, from side to side, while shifting the weight from one foot to the other. Two, let him move his hand from one side to the other in front of his face, all the time trying to imagine that he sees it moving. As soon as he becomes able to do this, it can be demonstrated that he really does see the movement. Simple as these measures are, they have always, either singly or together, brought relaxation and with it perception of light, in from 15 minutes or less to half an hour. In palming, the patient should remember that this does not bring relief unless mental relaxation is obtained, as evidenced by the disappearance of the white, gray, and other colors which most blind people see at first with their eyes closed and covered. Blindness, its cause and cure. By W. H. Bates, M.D. As ordinarily used, the word blindness signifies a degree of defective sight which unfits the patient for any occupation requiring the use of the eyes. Scientifically, it means a state in which there is no perception of light. Speaking of this condition in his Cause and Prevention of Blindness, Fuchs tells us that except in extraordinarily rare cases it is incurable, and this is the accepted opinion of ophthalmology today. The facts that have come to me during 35 years of ophthalmological practice have convinced me that the above statement should be reversed, and made to read, except in extraordinarily rare cases blindness is curable. In fact, unless the eyeball has been removed from the head, I should be unwilling to set any limits whatever to the possibility of relieving this greatest of human ills, for I have never seen a case of injury or disease of the eye which was sufficient to prevent improvement of vision. In all cases of blindness, whatever their cause, a mental strain has been demonstrated, and when this strain has been relieved, perception of light has always been obtained. Even when the eyeball has been so shrunken that the patient scarcely seemed to have an eye, sight has been restored. In one such case, the cornea of the left eye had shrunk to an eighth of an inch in diameter and only a suggestion of the sclera was visible, while the right eye was reduced to a quarter of its normal size and showed only a hazy cornea and a blurred piece of iris with no pupil. The patient was 10 years old and the condition of her right eye was congenital, present at birth. That of the left was due to an inflammation which she suffered when she was a year old. From that time, she had had no perception of light, but in 15 minutes she became able to see the furniture of the room indistinctly and to imagine that it was swinging. In spite of this remarkable demonstration of what could be accomplished by relaxation, her parents did not bring her again. Atrophy of the optic nerve is one of a considerable number of diseases, like detachment of the retina, iridocyclitis, and absolute glaucoma, which have been placed beyond the pale of hope by the science of ophthalmology. Yet persons with atrophy of the optic nerve sometimes have normal vision, and persons blind from this cause sometimes recover spontaneously. At the New York Eye and Ear Infirmary 30 years ago, a patient was exhibited who had all the symptoms of atrophy of the optic nerve, but who nevertheless possessed perfect sight. The case was exhibited later at the Manhattan Eye and Ear Hospital, the New York Ophthalmological Society, and the Ophthalmological Section of the New York Academy of Medicine. Later I saw several similar cases, but when a colored woman came to my clinic a few years ago with atrophy of the optic nerve, it did not occur to me that it would be possible to help her. Not knowing what to do, I asked her to sit down while I attended to some other patients, and meanwhile my assistant, Mrs. Learman, who tells the rest of the story in a later article, got hold of her and made her see. Later many cases were relieved. A few obtained normal vision, but most of them did not have the courage to continue the treatment long enough for this purpose. A few weeks ago a patient came to me completely blind in both eyes from atrophy of the optic nerve. Before he left the office he had become able, by the aid of the swing, to see the light with both eyes. He went away greatly encouraged, and promised to come again as soon as he returned from a neighboring city. Later he sent me a statement, signed by an oculist and witnessed by a notary public, to the effect that he was completely and incurably blind from primary optic atrophy. I have not seen him since. The following remarkable story of a spontaneous cure was told me recently by a patient, a commercial traveler, a friend of the man who told me the story, was treated for 2 years in a Chicago hospital for total blindness from atrophy of the optic nerve. Although the doctors told him that his case was quite hopeless, he refused to believe it. He talked much of a gray cloud that he had seen before his eyes at the time he became blind, and said that if he could only remember how it looked he was sure it would help him. One day he had a perfect mental picture of that gray cloud, and at once he found that he could see. He is now back in his old position, doing his usual amount of work, attending to his correspondence, and reading as well as he ever did. Doctors who have examined his eyes since say he still has atrophy of the optic nerve and ought still to be blind. Iridocyclitis, a combined inflammation of the iris and ciliary body, is a frequent cause of blindness. Often it results from an injury to the adjoining eye, and in that case is known as sympathetic ophthalmia. In severe cases, it is believed to lead inevitably to blindness, which is, of course, thought to be incurable. Yet in all cases in which blindness has resulted from this disease, I have seen perception of light, and even normal vision, restored. One day a young girl came to my clinic with one eye as soft as mush from iridocyclitis, the other having been removed 4 years before. The iris and pupil were covered by a white scar and she had no perception of light. After palming, swinging, and using her imagination for about 15 minutes, the scar cleared up sufficiently for me to see the iris and pupil indistinctly, and two visiting doctors also saw them, while the patient saw the light. Later she became able to see people on the street and to see the pavement and imagine that it was swinging. At that point she ceased coming to the clinic. A case of practical blindness from this cause was cured within a month by the use of the imagination. When the patient looked at the large letter at the top of the card at 1 foot and was told what it was, he was able to imagine that he saw it, and thus he became able to see it actually. Then he did the same thing at 10 feet. Next he imagined that he saw the first letter of the second line at 10 feet, and became able to recognize the second letter. The same method was used with all the other lines until he became able to imagine the first letter of the bottom line, and then go on and read the other letters. When his eye was examined with the ophthalmoscope, the vitreous was so opaque that one could not distinguish the optic nerve and retina. He said that the light bothered him, and prevented him from imagining any of the letters on the Snellen test card. With the retinoscope at 6 feet, however, he stated that the light did not bother him so much, and he was able to imagine, while it was being used, that he saw a letter on the bottom line perfectly. The refraction was then normal, and a clear red reflex, light reflected from the retina, was obtained, indicating that the vitreous was now quite clear. When he failed to imagine that he saw the letter, the reflex was much blurred, indicating cloudiness of the vitreous. These are facts. I cannot offer any explanation for them. Of detachment of the retina, Fuchs says, it is generally possible in recent and not too excessive cases of separation of the retina to obtain an improvement of the sight by a partial attachment, and in especially favorable cases even to cause the detachment to disappear completely. Unfortunately, it is only in the rarest cases that these good results are lasting. As a rule, after some time, the separation develops anew, and ultimately, in spite of all our therapeutic endeavors, becomes total. In inveterate cases of total detachment, it is better to abstain from any treatment. Compare this statement with the results obtained by central fixation, as told in the following article. In many other such cases, useful vision has been obtained. The incurability of blindness resulting from glaucoma is taken so completely for granted that Nettleship defines absolute glaucoma as glaucoma that has gone on to permanent blindness. Yet in the December 1920 issue of Better Eyesight, and again in this issue, is reported a case in which light perception was restored in an eye stone blind with glaucoma after a few minutes of palming. This was witnessed by several visiting doctors. Later the patient became able to read the 20 line at 10 feet with this eye. As nearly half of our blind population at the present time is believed to be over 60 years old, and a great part of the blindness of later life is attributed to glaucoma, the curability of this condition is a fact of immense importance. Statistics indicate that in this country, at the present time, External injury is the most frequent cause of loss of vision between the ages of 20 and 34. I believe that a great part of this blindness could be relieved, for, as I have already stated, I have never seen an eye so badly injured that its vision could not be improved. To cite only one of many similar cases, a patient injured in an automobile accident became suddenly and completely blind, either from hemorrhage into the orbit, or from injury to the optic nerve. By palming and the use of his imagination, he at once became able to count his fingers. Perhaps the most remarkable cures of blindness are those in which the loss of vision is supposed to be due to general disease. These have frequently been relieved, partially or completely, without relief of the disease. 30 years ago, a man stone blind with what I diagnosed to be albuminuric retinitis was led into my clinic at the New York Eye and Ear Infirmary. This condition is so closely associated with disease of the kidneys that its existence is considered sufficient evidence of the existence of the latter. Yet the patient regained normal vision and held it up to the time of his death without any improvement in the condition of the kidneys. On the contrary, the disease of these organs became worse, and when he died a few years later, the physicians who performed the autopsy wondered how he had been able to live so long. The evidence seems to me complete that the blindness was not due to the kidney trouble but to strain. Many diseases of the eye are attributed to syphilis. Yet in every case these conditions have been relieved by rest, and often the sight has become normal without any improvement in the syphilis. In spite of the very prompt improvement which patients obtain in these cases, they often, as the cases mentioned in the foregoing pages show, fail to continue the treatment. The weight of public and professional opinion is too much for them, and they are practically compelled to take this course. Such dogmatism is both unwise and unscientific. The causes of disease are obscure and variable, and we do not know it all. It does not seem to me that a doctor is justified in telling a patient that he is incurable just because he has never seen such a case cured, or has forgotten, because it was contrary to rule, any case that he has seen. This may cause the patient to accept as inevitable a condition which might have been cured and may even prevent nature, because of the depressing effects of discouragement, from doing what the doctor has failed to do. Still less is it justifiable for the medical profession to assume, as it now seems to do, that we have learned all there is to be known about blindness. Such an attitude throttles research and actually exposes to the suspicion of being a quack any man who tries to help these unfortunates.